have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. And a big, big thank you to everybody that participated last week.
That donated during our fund drive.
Thank you.
That was very sweet of everyone to pitch in on that and tolerate our breaks.
Yeah, makes it possible for us to do what we do. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So with that, let's dive into this week's news, starting with local and the Office of Professional Accountability.
Yeah, the Office of Professional Accountability, which is supposed to oversee the Seattle Police Department, issued a report this week on overtime practices at the SPD. And what they found is that the department lacked a policy for tracking and controlling overtime, and that supervisors often didn't keep accurate records of who worked how many hours and on what days. This really, to me, that's a basic management failure. As a result, according to the report, one unit, the training unit, wasted over $1 million on overtime in 2013 on a project that was never completed. That's the training portion of Mayor McGinn's and former Chief Diaz's 2020 reform plan, which was issued as a way to undercut the Department of Justice's agreement with the Seattle Police Department.
You mean they actually started trying to do something on that list? I thought it was press release.
They did. And the only thing, apparently, that they really geared up heavily on was guys in the training department decided they were going to put into practice as many of the training policies in the 2020 reform plan as they could. While officers ramped up the work on the 2020 training, they neglected, though, to follow through on basic street skills training for about one-third of patrol officers in the department. So even while they were pushing ahead on the training policies that Mayor McGinn and Chief Diaz came up with out of the blue to try to appease the Department of Justice, really to compete with the Department of Justice's requirements that they were putting forth in the DOJ agreement. The training department actually fell short on doing very basic street skills training for officers in the department, which I think is just a scandal.
And it's a huge issue, you know, even if you're very pro-law enforcement, it's a huge issue in terms of the safety of the officers themselves.
Yes.
When they're not adequately trained that way. And certainly it's a public safety issue in terms of the rest of the community when those officers are undertrained.
Yeah. And basically, when you allow your officers in the training department to push overtime over $1 million on a project that's been approved by the mayor and by the interim police chief, but hasn't been approved by the Department of Justice agreement. Basically, what you're saying is that this is not necessary. These are not necessary training that needs to be done. It's really a major waste, and it was not required by the court monitor later. Any of the training that was put together with all of this overtime money, and they basically blew the budget on that, so there wasn't enough budget left over to do the basic training that that was required even before the 2020 plan was kind of pushed on the department. Now, Chief O'Toole has begun a reform of the department's training practices, and she's now looking heavily into this overtime policy issue. And I would say that, yeah, she definitely needs to put together some kind of a department-wide policy on who gets to approve overtime, how that's tracked, and how the hours are paid for.
And she's doing that with 2020 hindsight.
Right? Indeed she is.
All right. Moving on, Governor.
Sorry, that hurt.
Governor Inslee.
I can tell you're feeling better this week.
Weighing in on oil trains here in the state.
Yeah. Governor Inslee coming out this week with what reforms he could do on oil trains in Washington State, which is a relatively new phenomenon. The first oil trains came through Washington State only in late 2012 with oil from the North Dakota fields. There's actually more oil moving through the state from North Dakota now than there is from Alaska, and it's been very poorly regulated by the federal government. We've talked about some of the problems with that in the past, and the fact that you've got food supplies literally rotting in silos in the Midwest because oil trains and the shipping of the oil has become so dominant and so profitable for the railroads and the railroads themselves. have not been able to cope with it. A number of the cars that are being used to transport the oil are very old and not particularly safe. Inslee this week basically calling them rolling bombs going through the waterfronts of Puget Sound's largest cities. And in fact, we dodged that bullet earlier this year when we had a major derailment near the Magnolia Bridge in Seattle that fortunately didn't result in any kind of explosion.
Fortunately, the train was moving very slowly, taking off from a dead stop.
Could have been different, and that's something Inslee's aware of. And so, unfortunately, he has very limited power to do anything. Almost all the power goes to the Department of Transportation and various other federal agencies that oversee the nation's rail network. But he has ordered the Department of Ecology to study the potential safety of some of these older trains and has been pressuring BNSF and some of the other rail operators to swap out some of the trains. Some of the oil companies themselves, in particular Valero, but some of the others have also pledged to only use the newer cars because, of course, they're concerned about liability also when you have explosions like the one up in Bellingham a while back that was a result of an old and faulty car. But really, with a lot of this, the responsibility lies with the federal government, and we're just not seeing a lot of movement on that front.
Yeah, and the federal government, the Department of Transportation, put into place a policy that would have required these older cars to be replaced within a two-year period, but that two-year period doesn't start until next October. So it's really 3 years before all those cars have to be replaced, 3 years in which we have mile-long oil trains chugging, you know, a couple dozen a day through our waterfront areas.
Yeah, and Inslee and Inslee is also hoping that the state legislature will pressure the federal government to change that to 1 year. But all he can do really is make the request. He doesn't have any actual authority to force that.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with the developments with the Ebola.
The Ebola guy, Thomas Duncan, a man from Liberia, probably everyone has seen the news, checked into the Texas Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas.
Twice.
Twice, yes. The first time when he went in, he told the intake nurse, yes, I just came from Liberia, where the Ebola epidemic is raging. And she didn't pass on, he or she, I don't know if it was a man or a woman, didn't pass on the information to the team who was treating him. And so the team who was treating him saw that he had a low-grade fever. They sent him home for bed rest. And for another 2 to 3 days, he was at home exposed and out in the community exposing other people to Ebola. Now, that is a major problem. And it really points up a couple things. First of all, it points up that hospitals in the United States are not prepared for dealing not just with Ebola, but with any major pandemic. This week, a survey by the National Nurses United group, a group that surveyed RNs, that's registered nurses, not LPNs, registered nurses across the nation, found that among their respondents, about 60% of the U.S. hospitals that those women work for, men and women work for, are not ready for an Ebola-type outbreak or a major pandemic. The Department of Homeland Security also agrees. It concluded in a recent report that the U.S. is unprepared for any kind of a pandemic. Now, the nurses' survey showed that three-fifths of U.S. hospitals don't have any procedures in place for handling Ebola patients, that there hasn't been nearly enough training so that intake nurses, for example, may not know the severity of an Ebola, possible Ebola infection, that there are not enough isolated units or equipment available. There's not enough supplies on hand to treat patients in isolation. And most particularly, there's not enough staff, particularly at hospitals in states like Texas, where there has been no expansion of Medicaid, so that hospitals are the frontline primary care providers for a huge number of people who don't have doctors and don't have health insurance. So staff at hospitals are often overwhelmed. If a person comes in with a fever, they're not necessarily going to ask, you know, are you from West Africa? They're going to say, oh, fever's not high enough. You're not bleeding. You're not having trouble breathing. Go home, drink water, and get bed rest.
Yeah. And that same survey, by the way, also showed that nurses thought a third of hospitals didn't have enough in the way of basic supplies.
Just
to treat a communicable disease outbreak like that. Now, you had the Obama administration officials getting up in front of a microphone yesterday to try and reassure the public that that everything's under control. And, you know, a couple of the things that the various officials were saying are true. There is not likely to be an epidemic of Ebola in the United States. The infrastructure for medical care and most especially medical reporting and tracking of diseases is much better here than it is in West Africa. And it is true, as those officials lined out, that the procedures are all in place in theory, to handle patients that come in like this. But there are a number of things that are left out of that story, and there have been left out of the media coverage, and the factors that Maria was mentioning certainly speak to some of them. The fact that not just in states that have not expanded Medicaid, but really across the country, to the nature of our healthcare system, emergency rooms are the primary care outlet for a number of people who don't have a regular doctor, who aren't regularly tracked by our healthcare system, and the kind of care that people get when the emergency room is their primary care facility is not the average or the highest level of care in the United States. Above and beyond that, the care that immigrants get or that people of color get in this country, looking at just about any public health indices, is vastly inferior to that well-fed officials in Washington, D.C. are getting. So you have somebody for whom maybe English is their first language, maybe it isn't. They're coming in from West Africa. They're a person of color. They're going to essentially the equivalent of Harborview, whatever the large general hospital is in a large city, whether it's Dallas or New York or D.C. or, you know, St. Louis or wherever it might be. They're not going to get a lot of attention. They're not going to be going to a hospital that is well-staffed, where there's a lot of training. And, yeah, things are going to fall through the cracks. And, yeah, some of those people are going to wind up exposing others in the community. And, you know, the whole sub-story of Duncan's partner and their children essentially being quarantined in their apartment, locked in their apartment for 4 days without any access to new food, with soiled linens, etc., and not really being having any relief to that until literally they called CNN to complain. It's very hard to imagine a middle-class white couple where the husband had traveled to West Africa on business and came back and demonstrated a fever. The level of care he's going to get is going to be very different, and his family and the network of people he's been in contact with are going to be treated very differently than what happened in Dallas.
And that said, I also want to speak to some of the hysteria around Ebola, particularly the right-wing hysteria about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It really speaks to the lack of biological knowledge people have in the United States, that you can have people saying stupid things like, all I need to do is just cough nearby and everybody in the room will get it.
It's not an airborne disease.
It's not an airborne disease. It really, if you are worried about it, read about it. There's lots of information out there about how Ebola spreads. You have to have not just direct contact with the person, but you have to have direct contact with some of their bodily fluids. This is a much bigger problem in West Africa, where there's no air conditioning and sweat is probably a constant for people who are living in West African countries. So, you're constantly exposed to people's bodily fluids. That's not necessarily true here in the United States. In addition, Ebola does not spread as actively as, say, something like the flu. And yet here in the United States, this flu season, we'll see more people die of the flu than we probably would see if we had an Ebola outbreak here in the U.S. In addition, what I find interesting about the right-wing hysteria over the Ebola outbreak and a potential for infections here is that a lot of the people who are saying, oh, my God, you know, we have to close our borders, we have to keep those Ebola people out, is that a lot of these right-wing politicians and pundits really don't support funding for our public health system. system, the very public health system that protects us from major pandemics like Ebola and other kinds of diseases. So I really find that very, very hypocritical. These folks don't even really understand how Ebola spreads and that it's not as virulent as some other things that we deal with routinely, like flu pandemics, flu outbreaks that kill a lot of people and kill people every year. And also they argue against funding in the public health system, which is really your first level of protection.
Yeah. The Centers for Disease Control, which is tracking this, has had something like 10% in budget cutbacks over the past couple of years.
Which is crazy.
Sequestration. And we don't have a Surgeon General in this country. And the reason is, of course, that the Republicans in the Senate have been blocking
approval. They don't think we need one.
They don't think we need one. And, of course, the nominee for it said something about gun violence being a public safety issue.
And
of course, we can't recognize that. And so we don't have a Surgeon General right at the time when somebody coordinating the public education about how things like this spread, how the public health system is or isn't equipped to respond to this would be really, really helpful. But we don't have that. And we certainly, as Maria said early on, we don't have the public health infrastructure in a place like Texas where Medicaid was not expanded. And that's put a tremendous strain on hospitals like Presbyterian in Dallas.
And without a public health system, we could be like Liberia, where people have to call a taxi to get to the hospital, you know, infecting themselves and the driver and who knows how many other people on their way to the hospital. They get to the hospital, there are literally people laying in the hallways and there's no room to put yet another Ebola patient in isolation. We could have that if we dismantled our public health system.
Yeah, but it's the free market.
I know.
Well, we don't have to worry about them riding the bus because we're dismantling that,
too. We're dismantling that, too.
Sticking with healthcare issues in Texas, there was a court ruling this week.
Yeah, a three-judge panel allowed the state of Texas to enforce a new abortion law that has two onerous requirements. One is that it requires abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the abortion clinic. And paradoxically, it also requires abortion clinics to have the same building requirements and equipment as surgical suites. Last summer, before the law was actually passed, Texas had 41 abortion clinics. After the law was passed, many of them had to shut down. The number is now down to 8, and all of those are in Houston, Austin, and two other major metropolitan areas.
And they're all in East Texas, and the reason for that is very simple, because West Texas is so spread out that most counties are not within 30 miles of a hospital.
Yeah, and 17%, that means about a minimum of 17% of Texas women of reproductive age now live more than 150 miles from a clinic. And unfortunately, the three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit Court, which is based in New Orleans and is considered one of the most conservative federal courts in the nation, decided that that wasn't enough women to make them put a stop on the enforcement of that new Texas law.
More to the point, it didn't affect any men.
Affect men, so they weren't concerned. Now, the plaintiffs, doctors, nurses, and reproductive rights activists say that they may appeal to the full Fifth Circuit Court, or they may try to skip over them and go to the Supreme Court with this.
All right. Moving on to California, plastic bag ban.
Yeah, two things passed in California this week. First, became the first state to pass a statewide plastic bag ban. And this, of course, is after both San Francisco and Los Angeles, the two main metropolitan areas in the state, had both banned plastic bags in their metropolitan areas. So congratulations to California for joining a very important environmental movement. Also in California this week, they passed a law to allow family members to petition a court to seize guns from someone who is a danger to themselves or others. This is the first time that a state has allowed someone other than the police to petition courts for the seizure of guns. Police could then, if family members or friends of a person who is going through, say, for example, a psychotic break and with violent tendencies, petition the court and are granted the ability to have the guns seized, police can then go seize the firearms and then put that person's name on a list of people who are prohibited from buying guns. This is very important because really family members are often the first people who recognize when someone is going through a mental health crisis like that. And they often call police asking, is there anything you can do? And police have to tell them, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do until that person has committed a crime. And usually by then it's too late.
And often against members of the family as well.
Yes.
And by the way, passing those kind of laws in California, and California has also rectified a number of its economic problems over the past couple of years. The reason is because they have elected a supermajority of Democrats, so that the chronic economic problems and failure to pass a budget, et cetera, that hamstrung the state for really a couple decades with Republicans in their state assembly blocking budgets, that's no longer been a problem the last couple of years. And so they can pass things like this. So the next time somebody tells you elections don't matter, they do matter. And the deadline for registration, as we'll mention for getting events for the November election, is coming up on Monday.
All right. And finally, nationally, a judge ordering the release of some Guantanamo tapes.
Yeah, Judge Gladys Kessler of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia ordered the public disclosure of 28 rather classified military videotapes, which hopefully the military hasn't gotten around to destroying this time around, that show the forced cell extraction and forced feeding of a hunger-striking Guantanamo Bay detainee. In doing so, it set a rather important precedent, especially for the D.C. federal court, of rejecting the Obama administration's arguments that those videotapes should not be released because releasing them posed a threat to national security, because, of course, you know, it would incite potential terrorists, et cetera, which is a routine argument that the Obama administration has been using to head off all kinds of challenges, for whether it's Guantanamo Bay or federal surveillance of phones or electronic records and so forth, any number of different privacy and civil rights issues over the past few years. Kessler ruled that such arguments were, quote, unacceptably vague and speculative, lacking specificity, or, quote, just plain implausible. That ruling hopefully will set a precedent for other fronts as well as drawing attention to the fact that in this nation with a very short memory, most people have forgotten that we do still, in fact, have prisoners, not detainees, but prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. Some of them have been languishing there for over a decade. They have never been charged, let alone convicted with anything. And there's a lot of evidence in some of the cases that they're not guilty of anything. But for various, mostly political reasons, they are still there and they are still being tortured.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Hong Kong.
Yes, the protests in Hong Kong. It's been playing out in the Western media as Occupy Central, the group that has stepped forward to try to take a leadership role there, as a showdown between them and between Chinese President Xi Jinping and his proxy, the chief executive of Hong Kong, Liang Chengying. When, in fact, really, that's not what the protests are all about. The protests started with a group of students going out into the street, protesting against changes at the university level that they thought were undemocratic. And when they were tear gassed by the Hong Kong police, a whole bunch of other Hong Kong residents went out into the street to support them. There's a lot of unhappiness in Hong Kong, particularly among the middle class, because of the lack of jobs available for middle-class Hong Kong residents. A lot of the jobs in Hong Kong have been going to mainland Chinese who are willing to work for less money. And also, in essence, a lot of jobs that used to be available to Hong Kong residents are being offshored to mainland China. So folks there are unhappy because there's a wealthy elite in Hong Kong that is growing richer, and a lot of people in the middle class are growing poorer. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? But of course, that's not what the media is reporting on. What they're reporting on is a fight over whether or not Hong Kong citizens will be allowed to elect their own candidate for chief executive of Hong Kong. That election is coming up, and although the public law in Hong Kong's under the Chinese government allows them to elect their chief executive, it still specifies that the candidates for chief executive have to be approved by a committee that is dominated by the Chinese Central Committee.
Yeah, the other piece of context in this is that the protests in Hong Kong have, in fact, been massive. But there have been a number of very large protests in different Chinese cities, especially in Fujian province and some of the other areas in South and Southeast China that are both culturally and geographically a long way from Beijing over the past several years over very similar issues. A lot of cities that you've never heard of, even though they may have several million people in them. And these kind of protests are almost never covered by Western media, but because there are Western media who are actually present in Hong Kong, this particular protest is getting a lot more attention. But it's part of a much larger movement that isn't necessarily pro-democracy with the way it's being spun in Western media, because it's a very different political context. But it is very much objecting to the central planning, the lack of local control, the lack of environmental standards in
the
a
corruption.
Lot of these cities, the corruption, and the mass migration of people from the interior of the country who are, as Maria mentioned, often willing to work for much lower wages and really work in terrible, terrible condition, displacing the more educated, more experienced workforce in the coastal cities.
All right. And finally, it appears Turkey is going to be joining the war in the Middle East.
Yeah, the Turkish parliament, this is something that got attention in the British press, not so much in the U.S., but the Turkish government and the Turkish parliament agreed this week to join the fight against ISIL, the United States-led coalition that's going to war there, and particularly indicated a willingness to send ground troops into Syria. Now, this, to the extent that it got coverage in the West, was treated as good news and treated as an endorsement and a ratification for President Obama's priorities in fighting ISIL, that you had a large Muslim country that obviously the U.S. is very close to militarily, a NATO ally in Turkey and so forth, but a Muslim country that can send Muslim troops into the fight. But what was entirely missing from this coverage is that Turkey has its own motivations that have little or nothing to do with ISIS, because that part of Syria, as well as parts of northern Iraq, and for that matter, Iran, are really more Kurdistan than anything else. There's a heavy Kurd population in all three of those countries, as there is in southeast Turkey. And now the southeast Turkey Kurds have been fighting for independence and have been pretty brutally repressed by the Turkish military for many, many years.
For over a generation.
And Turkey has long complained that the Kurds and the rebels go back and forth across the border, and they go across the border into Syria and from Syria, and arms flow and so forth. And so Turkey is seeing this as an opportunity, and this is really their primary motivation for getting involved, an opportunity to weaken Syrian Kurds and Kurds in general, even as Kurds in Iraq are fighting ISIL and are a main U.S. ally in that region. So this is not necessarily good news. This is a much it introduces a much more complicated dynamic to what's already a very complex situation, and underscores once again that the U.S. is opening a real can of worms in that part of the world that it doesn't understand very well.
Events.
Several coming up. As you mentioned, Monday is the last day for online registration for the general election in November. If you go to the Secretary of State's website for the state or King County elections, you can register online. Now, after Monday, you can still register in person, but it's much easier to do it online.
You can just type into your browser vote.wa.gov.
Yeah. Also on Monday, 2 o'clock, Seattle City Council is going to be taking a vote on whether to rename the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day. That as you're going to get a lot of attention Monday night, as our beloved football team is playing the Washington racists on Monday Night Football. So good time to be thinking about those kind of issues. Also on Monday, in the evening from 7 to 9 o'clock, Are We Safer Now? The Future of Nuclear Power in the Northwest, 3.5 years after Fukushima, with Dr. Edwin Lyman, who's the senior scientist of the Global Security Program of the Union for Concerned Scientists, that sponsored by Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, free of charge, will be held at University Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District Monday at 7. And then Thursday night at 7:30, Dr. Cornell West is going to be in town. That is sold out, but there will be a limited number of tickets the day of that $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.